reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Millott, and today's guest is Pauls Tatonge. I've known Pauls for a few years now. We first met when he came through Wichita on tour for his book Red Weather, and we managed to bond very quickly over a conversation about Michael Ondaatje, a favorite author for both of us. We hooked up again when he came through on tour for Evel Knievel Days, his second novel. Both of these books are excellent. You should go out and get them right away if you don't have them already. well, okay. When I Pauls and I had set up to talk at about 6 p.m. one day, and I gave him a call and on time, and apparently he was still on his way back home, and I kept the exchange in here just because it amused me, and I don't know, maybe it won't amuse you, but it amuses me, and small, weird, bizarre things amuse me. That might be part of also why I like Pauls. He's a little bizarre and weird and fun to talk to and brilliant, so let's get right to it. Here's my conversation with Pauls Tatonge. Go out and get his books. You will enjoy them, I promise. Thanks.
Hello?
Pauls.
Hey, how
Jason?
Are you?
Not too bad. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm on a bicycle, but I should be able to do this.
Do I just need to wait a couple of minutes?
Well, I'm sort of in transit. To what extent? Hold on one second. to what extent are we on a very specific? It's not live, is it? Is it live?
No, not live.
Okay. So that would actually, I'm bicycling back to my house, and
okay.
So I will probably be there in about, I would say, 8 minutes.
Okay.
Or maybe 10.
No worries. I'll ring you back in about 15.
Okay, that sounds great. Because you're on Skype. Okay. All right.
I'm on.
Okay. Yeah. 15 minutes. Okay. Sounds
all right.
Great. Sorry.
All right. No problem. See you then.
Okay.
Hey.
Hey.
This is Jason again.
Yeah. How are you?
Not too bad. Are you comfortable? Do you have to drink?
I'm sitting here, so I'll describe what happened to you. We're on vacation in a place called Sun River, Oregon, with all of Peyton, my wife's extended family. And so we went to the swimming pool, and we went to the swimming pool, and I can go upstairs. I'll go upstairs. Okay, can you unplug it? Hey, Peyton. And should I give you the sleeping baby also? Yeah. Okay, I'll lay her down. So we went to the swimming pool, and we're taking the kids who are four. We're bringing them into the. Oh, she woke up.
Uh-oh.
Here, she's awake. Oh, no. Oh, hard to tell. Okay. we're taking them from the pool to the bike and then getting back to the house. And so we get to the house, and on the way there, she falls asleep. So I'm holding the child, and I walk in, and, she's asleep on my chest, but When she falls asleep like that, she'll sleep through a fire alarm. So,
right.
But now Peyton took her away, and I'm free.
You're so responsible. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, I'm. It's a family vacation, so this is always a kind of a crazy thing. You know, lots of children.
Right.
There's four children between the ages of 2.5 and 6.
Right. So yeah, it's a vacation, but you're still working.
Yes, very much so. Exactly. Very much so. And how are you? I mean, are you still with the, you know, fellows?
The Evil Empire? The Death Star?
Yeah. Good. And
well, I can pay the student loans, so I'm not too worried about that.
Good. That's important. Paying the student loans is important.
So the last time we talked was you came through town for Evel Knievel days.
Yeah.
And we went out and as way of a segue, because what finally prompted me to contact you again, let me back up a bit. I tried to get you on the podcast back in January, I think.
Yeah,
and we just kind of went left on that and finally got you this time. And what prompted me was that piece that showed up in the LA Review.
Sure.
At least that's where I found about it. So it feels like it's been a really long time then, because that's a huge change.
Yes, no, are we on? We're recording, right?
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
And if you don't mind talking about it. I mean,
no, that's fine. No, that's totally fine. It's totally fine. You know, I mean, obviously, I published the piece. I was nervous. I was nervous about publishing that because it's obviously so personal. I think that art, yeah, I think that, you know, when I was on that tour for Evel Knievel Days, you know, I had a good time. I mean, it's not that I wasn't, waking up with a whiskey bottle in my hand, like Charles Bukowski or something. But
it wasn't Big Sur.
No, it wasn't Big Sur. No, not at all. And, you know, but I think that the interesting thing is, as a writer, you know, your life is so unmanageable anyway. You know, you have so much that you have to give up control of, relinquish control of, you know.
Right.
I think that my experience of writing anyway has been that you don't understand what you're doing, really. I mean, I think you believe you're doing one thing, and you probably are close in a lot of ways, but then in a lot of ways, you know, the reception of your work is something that you could never anticipate.
Oh, yeah.
I think. And I think that is true the more complicated your work is, I think, maybe. I don't know. But I think that for me, with that unmanageability being sort of central in my life, added unmanageability of alcohol was just too much, and I just couldn't handle it. And so I made the decision, and, you know, it's funny, a lot of people who are alcoholics will tell you this, that once you realize, because it's not something that you realize or that you can, that a lot of people can, are comfortable sitting with, that it's an enormous relief. And, you know, and so it was really terrific. It was it felt like I was relinquishing this thing that I had been managing for so long, and it was gone. So that was really great.
Yeah, you kind of hit that spot where you're not able to tell yourself, I got this anymore.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. No, I think that's true. I mean, and I think that while, you know, I wasn't, my life was actually going to, from any outside perspective, people would probably say, oh, he's successful, you know. But from the inside, it felt different.
Right. Yeah, well, the bottom looks different to everybody.
Sure. Sure, this
You
is
know,
true.
I mean, it doesn't have to be some squalid, back alley and encounter with a hooker and a monkey for you to realize you've got a problem.
No, I
You
mean,
know.
it's actually tough to find a hooker and a monkey who will collaborate.
That's
That's
true. Well, you know.
rare. That's a rare bottom, so to speak.
Well, let's back up a little bit even more.
This is the
'Cause
internet, man. We can be, we have freedom on. This is freedom of speech at its finest right here.
right. So let's
Unless your grandmother is listening to this, which,
all my
or,
grandparents are passed.
oh, yeah, mine as well. So there you go.
Yep. So let's go back to the beginning, 'cause we kind of leapt forward, to the present, but let's backtrack and let's pick up, 'cause I always ask this of the few people of the, what is it? I think you're number 19 or number 20 so far. So I always like to get their origin story under the premise, that writers are closeted superheroes. So,
I love it.
and not everybody, although my audience is small, not everybody I think will have read you. Part of a reason I think some people listen is for discovery. So let's get the short bio for you. Where are you from originally, Mr. Tungay?
Well, I'm originally from Seattle, Washington, and my folks were both immigrants. My mom is from Latvia. She was born in Latvia, and my dad is from Egypt, and he was born in Cairo. And they met, as of course all Egyptians and Latvians do, in a undergraduate French class at the University of Washington. So, from that beginning, they sort of settled in. They both settled in Seattle, and then I was born in 76. I just had my 38th birthday, which now 76 used to feel like it was the recent past, and now
I
it
know.
feels like it's receding into the distant past. But yeah, what else? I
Wait
don't know.
until you get to 40, man.
Right. No. Well, my wife is 41, Peyton Marshall, and she, whose book is coming out actually,
Oh, cool.
it's really terrific. Maybe she can do the podcast. She's just a terrific writer. I think you'd really love her book.
Absolutely.
It's called Good House, and it's coming out in September.
Another one
But
I know of in September, because
who?
Laird Hunt's got one in September, and
Oh.
so does Emily St. John Mandel, two of another.
Yes.
So
Yeah. She's great.
I'll add a third one to it. I'll get Peyton's.
Yeah, September's a big month. Big month. But that's my family origin story. Insofar as both those cultures were around when I was a kid, and I went to Latvian school and spoke Latvian
Really?
yeah, I learned Latvian, and I still speak Latvian, and I'm taking my kids who are 4 to the Latvian camp. There's a Latvian camp called Mežuhakme, which is it's located outside of Olympia, Washington,
Oh,
and
cool.
so it's like a week-long summer camp. And they so it's all in Latvian. When I went to that Latvian camp, it was a hardline thing, because this was during the days of the Soviet Union, and Latvian culture was being defined in opposition to this occupation in the country. So, the preservation of the language was this deep patriotic duty, and so there it was kind of a They, the older generation of Latvians, felt it was sort of a sacred obligation. So we had a very stringent requirement. It was totally, you couldn't speak any Latvian at all, and if you did, you got into huge trouble. I mean, excuse me, you couldn't speak any English at all, and if you did, you got into huge trouble. But now the rules have relaxed a lot, and it's sort of a bilingual summer camp.
Oh, cool. What do you do at Latvian camp?
Well, you do kind of summer campy stuff. You have bonfires and capture the flag with the kids, although you have to be a little careful, and with the smaller ones, and because it can get pretty heated, you know.
Right.
And you know, marshmallows and s'mores and gross cafeteria food, and then every day actually starts with the Latvian national anthem at the flagpole with the raising of the Latvian flag.
Wow.
Yeah, and
you guys would be a cult now.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, if it didn't have an actual antecedent in historical antecedent, then it would be a cult. It may still be a cult, actually.
So were there a lot of like cultural classes and things and history that was also done at the camp, or was it just doing camp things and doing it in Latvian?
Yeah, well, no, there were all sorts of things. Some of it was based on the exiles who happened to be in the Pacific Northwest. So, for instance, there was a very well-known jewelry maker, very famous jewelry maker, who was an exile during the Second World War and settled in the Pacific Northwest. And so he would come to camp and he would teach a jewelry making class, you know, and make traditional Latvian jewelry. There's a ring called the Dame Gretis, which means ring of the Dame. And it has sort of a braided design where you have ropes of metal of varying size that are braided together. It makes kind of a braided ring. It kind of looks like a Celtic, one of those Celtic braids, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh. And what's it called again?
It's called a Name Gretzen. Name Gretzen. And it's Gretzen is the word for a ring in Latvian. And Name was a guy, actually. There's a story about it, which is that he was this patriot. You know, Latvia has this long history of occupation, and so this guy was a sort of freedom fighter, and he wore this very distinctive ring, which seems like a bad idea to me if you're a freedom fighter, you know, to identify yourself if you're fighting the guerrilla war.
This was pre-internet days, right? So, I mean, it was...
Pre-internet days.
You had to get pretty close to see what he had on his finger.
True, very true, very true. But so I guess that the word went out that he had this ring, and so they were looking for him, and so then all the Latvians started to wear this exact ring so that they wouldn't be able to identify him by...
Oh, right.
This ring. It's sort of an I Am Spartacus moment.
Right. Cool.
But anyway. Yeah, so wow, we went off on a giant tangent there.
No, that's cool. That's kind of what I'm doing. I mean, my family never really did much of the cultural heritage thing. My dad's side has never really known what their heritage was. They're just kind of these mutts.
Yeah.
I suspect they came over as indentured servants at one point.
Huh. And who? What about your mom's side?
Came over. My mother is second generation born in America.
Mm-hmm.
My great grandfather came over when he was a child. Sometime around the turn of the century.
Where was he from?
Germany.
Germany.
And so, yeah. So, you know, they dropped an N off of the last name at one point. They did some other stuff to Americanize it because, you know, by the time my mother was born, you know, the Germans had been the instigators of two world wars. So they kind of, you know, said like, yeah, we're not going to make a big deal out of it. You know, because
my
great grandfather had been loosely associated with a German-American Bund around the First World War, and that didn't go well. And so they just kind of, you know, we're Americans, we run a funeral home, we have a German-sounding last name, but it only has one N. Hitzman, with one N instead of two, which was apparently how it was originally spelled. So,
wow. Well, you know, I mean, Yeah, there's a pretty large Germanic population in Kansas, isn't there? I mean, from right around that time, wasn't there a big influx of Eastern Europeans to the Midwest?
It's mostly the northern Germanics, like the Swedes and the
Norwegians.
Norwegians, and not so much the actual Prussian German wackadoos, you know.
Right, right.
That's
right.
More Illinois and Iowa is where they first landed.
Yeah, it's interesting. All the country was peopled by immigrants, and you know.
Yeah. Now we're farting about immigrants like it's a problem.
Right, exactly. Which to me, it makes just no sense.
None at all.
Right.
So when we were done with Latvian summer camp, now didn't you live in Wisconsin for a while?
I did. I lived in Wisconsin for a while in 2003, 2005, working on my dissertation. I was in graduate school,
uh-huh.
and working on that and working on my novel also. It's where I started Red Weather, my first novel.
Okay, and, so the family was never in Wisconsin. You were just there in school.
No, I was just there. Yeah, I was just there.
So you did all of your growing up in Seattle then?
Yeah, I did all my growing up in Seattle. And I've never been able to write about Seattle. I tried to write about Seattle in a very experimental novel that did not get published. That was set in Seattle, but I sort of do feel about Seattle, you know, and I apologize to anyone if you have anyone from Seattle listening to this, but I do sort of feel like, at least in the Seattle that I was raised in, there was no there, you know, there was no culture. I mean, I think you had sort of a music culture in a way, that was kind of a drug culture also, but the music culture was so quickly commodified, you know.
Right.
This is the thing about subcultures in our time is as soon as they're identified, they are commodified.
Right.
So,
and marketed to and changed into a product. And
yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the question of like, what was that music culture and how long did it last and where was it located, is a really good question. And I don't think it's a simple answer. So I don't know I've always sort of felt like, oh, there's not really a story. There's not really the culture there, but that's so terrible to say that about a place, but I feel like having been raised there, I can have some amount of judgment.
Yeah. I kind of had the same feeling. I mean, I didn't grow up completely in Wichita. I just went to got here before I started high school. I grew up out in Western Kansas in Dodge City of all the places.
Huh.
And there was really kind of nothing there. And, you know, there's something going on in Wichita now, but I don't ever really feel connected to it. And when I was in high school here, it felt like the only thing you did in town was on Friday and Saturday night going cruise Douglas, with, in a car with six of your friends, and at stoplights, everybody would get out and do what the Chinese fire drill and run around the car and get back in. And, taking drugs, and that was about it.
Right.
And so I've never really wanted to write about Wichita either. It's just, I've been trying so hard to get out of here. Why would I, want to glorify the place with a story?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and then it's also, every project is so, takes a long time, if you're writing a novel, it takes a long time. So it's not like you can do a bunch of, you can write a ton of novels, you know, and so choosing to write something, I would have to find a really amazing story or imagine a really amazing story in order to write something set in Seattle. But maybe once I found a great story that was set in Seattle, then I would be like a natural at writing the Seattle novel. So maybe you have this deep-seated, buried like Wichita novel in you that's just like waiting. You find the right story and then you write the Wichita novel, the great Wichita novel.
I think Scott Phillips might have that cornered.
Scott Phillips, Scott Phillips, that's right,
You know, because he's got them in, well, they're all noir crime and stuff, which, you know, fits because the town's kind of corrupt, but.
Yeah, couldn't you write about the current big employer in Wichita? Couldn't you write that novel?
Probably not while I'm working for him.
No. If you have the hope of remaining
alive,
alive, right? No, just kidding. Just kidding. Only kidding. I have no judgment based on anything. Life is. Oh man. Anyway.
Yeah. Now, did you go to did you do your undergraduate there in Washington, or did you flee?
I fled. What?
No, where to?
Well, I went east. I went to Middlebury College undergrad.
That's right.
And then I went to Cornell University for graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
In
there's a Malott Hall at Cornell.
There is?
Yeah.
Is it any relation to?
Probably very, very distantly. Dean Waldo Malott, or Dean Malott, was the chancellor at Cornell for a while. He was also the chancellor at KU, so there's a Malott Hall at KU, which may have been why I went to K-State. But
you didn't want to have your...
I didn't want to constantly have to answer that question, are you related?
Right.
And apparently I could have gotten, if I were, you know, easily, provably, directly related, I could have gotten scholarship money to go to KU.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, you must have been.
Stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
Like I said, my family doesn't really know. I've tried doing genealogy research on my dad's side of the family, and when I get to my great-grandfather, it just falls apart.
Yeah.
And I have no idea why. I can't figure it out. Maybe it's just I'm not a good genealogist, but it's like I've tried to track my grandfather to figure out roughly. I know my great-grandfather's name was David, but I've seen in various census things that my grandfather's father was listed as Carl Sr., as David, as Carl with a K, Carl with a C, last name spelled with just like three different ways. That's what I mean by it all just kind of falls apart at my great-grandfather.
Right.
No freaking
idea.
Well, it's
tough because you really have to, it's a big effort to try and track down, you know, folks like that in the record. It's
especially
hard. It's not easy.
Turn of the century rural Kansas, I think that family was partially illiterate.
Really?
Yeah, my grandfather was born in 1911.
Your grandfather was born in 1911, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah. That makes sense.
So, I'm sure my aunt knows more, but I don't talk to her much.
Well, what's the focus? What is your sort of, do you have a, is there like some kind of single question that you ask every
usually at the end? It's just kind of a wandering, you know, conversation. We were at Cornell when we sidetracked into genealogy.
I'm so fascinated by genealogy. I can't even tell you. I have this beautiful on my dad's side of the family. So that's the other side is Egyptian, and they're from Aleppo in
Syria and in sort of the Turkey, the area, the province of Aleppo, mm-hmm. which is right now being, shelled out of into oblivion.
Yeah.
And also is being claimed by ISIS as part of their new,
Oh, fantastic.
It is fantastic. Yeah. And, anyway,
this is with as much irony as I can muster.
Right, exactly. Right. they have on that side of the family, I have this beautiful document that is a family tree, going basically from 1740 to actually a little earlier than that, 1715 to 1900.
Wow.
And it's all the male genealogy, and mm-hmm. it has my great grandfather on there, and then possibly my grandfather is one of the last petitions. Mm-hmm. But it's all in Arabic, and it's drawn. It's in calligraphy, and it's drawn on a tree. So it's an actual tree, and then every family is a branch that sort of reaches off of the tree. So.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, the document itself is gorgeous. And I've always wanted to incorporate it into something, but it's a document that is you can't really get a sense of it without being in front of it because it's huge.
Right.
It's probably 3 feet tall, wow. 4 feet. Probably 3 feet tall, 4 feet tall maybe, and 2 feet wide. And so replicated as a page in a book, first of all, I don't think you could get, you wouldn't be able to read it. You wouldn't be able to read it, but you'd have to read classical Arabic anyway. But you wouldn't be able to, you wouldn't be able to read it. But it's also just not as visually impressive. I've always wanted to, I always wanted to figure out some way to put it into something or set it up.
It'd have to be an insert with a fold out so you could,
that's a very cool idea, actually. But then you have to get the press that's willing to do that. I feel like only McSweeney's or maybe Tin House would be willing to do something like that. But you'd have to get really lucky.
All of those Nick Bantock books? Who was that? Simon and Schuster, I think.
Yeah, Simon and Schuster. It's a big. Yeah, but he's got a reputation, That's the weird thing about writing.
Yeah, you kind of have to establish the form breaking reputation before they let you break the form.
Right. Exactly. I know. That's true. It's like there's a lot of people who, probably would be willing to do more experimental things, but you can't get them off the ground, really.
Right.
I don't think. I mean, there are some exceptions, obviously, with House of Leaves, or, maybe Jimmy Ball or something, but he's not physically experimental. Or maybe a little bit, but.
Yeah. So now, what were you doing at Cornell?
I was in this program that is a kind of rare program where you do a joint literature PhD and creative writing MFA. And you end up getting 3 degrees in an MFA, an MA in English literature, and a PhD in English literature. And what does it do? It's the same. Typically for a PhD, you have to take eight courses.
Right.
I believe it's either eight or six. I can't remember, but, semester long modules, but, here, let me think. It's probably two. Well, it might be eight. I think it might be eight. But anyway, whatever it is, you have to take two less as in this program, and your creative writing and say classes count as two of your, I believe it's eight, two of your eight classes toward getting your PhD. So it's, you basically do everything that a PhD student does. You,
right.
You know, I did a oral exam. I did a, you know, dissertation defense. I wrote the dissertation. And,
yeah. Pulled out your hair.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did a little bit. It was more, that was, yeah, you know, it was an interesting program. It's the, it's hard. I don't know. That's a personal thing for me. I always feel like, I struggle with being the outsider, you know, and like, that's a struggle that I have for whatever reason. And
a struggle with wanting to be an outsider, or a struggle with being an outsider and wanting to be in?
Yeah, feeling like I'm always desirous, or in the past, I don't have this anymore really now in the current incarnation of my life, but certainly in college and in graduate school, I really sort of dreamed that I would have much more of a community than I did. And I just didn't have a community. I mean, it sounds kind of pathetic now that I'm listening to myself say it, but like,
don't worry about it sounding pathetic. I have no community. I had a better community in graduate school than I do right now. And I'm yearning for a community. So
right.
Don't knock it.
No, I know. It's pretty, I mean, like having a, like it's so important, I think, just from the perspective of, I sometimes think like, God, what if I went and just got an MFA somewhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But it's like, I feel like it's so important for a writer to feel like they have colleagues who, you know, are in the same place that they're at. They are.
Right.
And I tried to do that. But I never quite fit in, you know. I wasn't quite sophisticated enough for the for the PhD students, and then
right.
and the MFA students kind of looked at me like, you know, who is this guy who wants to get a PhD, and why does he want to do that? He's kind of suspect.
Right.
And to, you know, to make matters worse, I was sort of out of genre. They slotted me into. I applied without really knowing much about, you know, to apply, you had to give a creative sample. Take the GRE literature exam, give a creative sample of your work, and send in a critical sample of your work.
Wow.
So I wrote about Mrs. Dalloway in my critical sample. And I think it was an interesting thing. I was interested in modernism and I was interested in Mrs. Dalloway. And you know, which is like one of my favorite books to this day. It's just beautiful. And so I had this creative sample that was both poetry and fiction. And so they looked at it and they put me in the poetry workshop. I don't know if that was a commentary on my fiction. But so I got there and I thought, oh, I'll definitely, okay, I'm in the poetry workshop, but I'll definitely be able to take fiction classes, right? But yet, in fact, I was not able to. So I felt like I wasn't a poet, I wasn't a PhD student. I was just floating around. Hanging out in Ithaca, going to the Chanticleer, which is a fucking awesome little, you know, bar. It's like named after, you know, a character from Chaucer, but it's probably the farthest thing from a literature bar that exists in Ithaca. just kind of a rough, nasty place. But I fit right in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was after Cornell that you went to Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, sort of during. So when you're in like a graduate programs like that, you have a fair, if you can work it right, you know, I combined like fellowships with student loans.
Right.
And I had a lot of mobility. And so I was dating someone at the time who got a job in Wisconsin. And so I was able to sort of travel out there and then do work on my own. You know, it was kind of this wonderful time where I first was out there in 2002, actually, because it was during that World Cup. And I think that was the Korean World Cup, Korea and Japan. I loved that. Watched every game and played one man soccer out on the in the lawn of where we were living.
You really were an outsider. One man soccer. That's got to be a lonely game.
One man soccer. Yeah, that was lonely. It's tough. It's a tough game to play, man. You just be one man soccer. I'm just gonna let you imagine what that game is like, and then anything you imagine, just know that the answer is yes.
All right.
Yeah. Wait, but did you? Yes, I did. I did that. That's how I played one man soccer. Anyway.
Okay, so all of this stuff, I mean, I had a friend of mine in graduate school who got stuck in the poetry track.
Yeah.
Who really preferred to write prose. Right. But at Naropa, they let us cross-pollinate.
Right. It's awesome, and which is why Naropa is a great program.
I loved it. I wouldn't trade it for the world, although it was way more expensive than I should have been allowed myself to consider.
Right.
They encouraged us to cross-pollinate, to take poetry workshops, to do stuff like that. And my friend Jen took so many prose classes that when she walked across the stage to pick up her diploma, even though she had been enrolled in and classified as the poetry track, and her advisor was a poet, they announced her diploma as being in prose when she walked across the stage, and she about fell off the stage. So I've always referred to her as the prose ninja.
That's great. I mean, you know, it's like, I feel like these divisions between poetry and prose are just so absurd, and I'm actually really angry at it. I'm really angry about it because I think that it's part of that commodification of writing and the commercialization of writing, because it makes it, you know, it's all about, what it does is it says the product that you create is more important than the act of writing, the act of putting language together,
and more important than the act of reading.
Absolutely more important than the act of reading. Although you could argue that the MFA program, maybe, you know, depending on how it's structured and how it's run and who's doing it, you know, could be that same problem. Could have that same problem.
Yeah, that's what, you know, that's when I heard them come up with the whole new genre of, what is it, new adult? That's one of the new publishing classifications they've got out there, new adult.
New adult?
Yes, it's sandwiched in between young adult and then everything else. And they created it in order to create kind of a little comfortable cushion for all those kids that grew up reading Harry Potter and have now hit their 20s. Because, you know, they've been told all their lives.
New adult.
New adult, yes.
Okay, that is just so disgusting.
It is. Ask your agent about it. Come on.
It's so disgusting.
Well, yeah, it's these kids that have been told all their lives by the parents, you know, good intentioned parents and good intentioned educators. Let's pick books that are age appropriate. This set of books says they're for, you know, 12 to 18, and this says it's for, you know, 8 to 10, and make sure you step them up into reading. And it's like, I heard about the new adult thing and I wanted to, you know, bang my head on the table.
Yeah, and not to mention, I mean, there's so much wrong with it, but not to mention that young adults itself, I mean, if young adults had been around as a classification, you know, 50 years ago, Catcher in the Rye would have been young adult. To Kill a Mockingbird would have been young adult. I mean, any of these books would have, you know, Lord of the Flies. These would all been young adult, quote unquote. And so it's a way of simultaneously marketing and dismissing the importance of a kind of book, you know. And also, and actually, honestly, I also think that it is a way of instituting gender bias in the sort of literary world, because women, you know, write about, you know, sort of, you know, 18, 19, 20 year old people, and 16, 17, you know, and it's young adult, but men write about that, and it's like serious literature or something like that.
Right.
And it's just, I think it's just the biggest load of crap that's out there. And it really drives me absolutely crazy. I mean, I think that Jonathan Franzen is like Exhibit A.
it's a total exercise in ghettoization. You put and to me, it destroys that sense of discovery that should be associated with reading, and it destroys that sense of transgression that kids used to get by reading stuff that was not quote unquote appropriate for their age.
That's really interesting. I've actually not thought of that before. I mean, the transgressiveness was a big part of why I was drawn to reading when I was a young adult, quote unquote.
Absolutely. Me too. I mean, I picked up the Satanic Verses simply because I wanted to shock all of my stupid high school friends.
Yeah, me too. I did the same thing. That's funny. That's so funny. And I couldn't get through it. I actually read it like probably 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe 9 years ago, actually. And but I tried to read it in high school. I couldn't get through it.
Yeah. When you finally read it, did you like it?
Rushdie is so interesting. I love Midnight's Children. I think it's just such a beautiful, crazy, complicated, lovely, intelligent book. And his prose is so, sort of littering in that case. And I loved like Harun and the Sea of Stories and Luca and the Fire of Life, you know, the young adults.
the stuff he wrote for his boys.
The stuff he wrote for his boys, yeah. But I just, the Satanic Verses, I couldn't get into it in the same way that I got into Midnight's Children. It was somehow less beautiful or something.
Mm. Okay.
I have a lot of beauty bias, I guess, in my face as a writer, and that's, I think that, I don't know, it was interesting. I mean, it was interesting. The way that once he, you know, the one guy who's like, sort of, you follow him through the underworld kind of thing. Oh. And
God, it's been so long since I've read it. I mean,
I think you follow his character in contemporary London, and that's really interesting, and it has this balance against sort of this older story, you know, of Muhammad, and it's
and the transcriber,
the guy who's transcribing the Quran, and it's like, and he's, you know, and he's lying more and more. That's kind of fun. I mean, I just read and reviewed Rivka Galchin's collection of short stories for the Los Angeles Review of Books. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, I had kind of the same, I mean, I thought it was a really great book, the collection of stories, but it was very heady. It was very like deeply in the intellect and not sort of, I don't know how to explain that. And I feel like there's a real affinity with that aspect of her work. And then also with Rushdie, I feel like he's, you know, that's also, but that's more so in the satanic verse, you know. I mean, there are some great jokes later, like when he's actually, when the guy, when the scribe is pushing it really far, like, I remember, now I'm starting to come back to me, he's like changing the word of God, basically, as he's writing it down, and that's kind of amazing and astonishing, right. But
it's all cranial. It's all intellectual. It's
cranial.
We used to, and when I was in grad school, we used to say that a writer that was doing that was eating their own brain.
Yes, totally.
And it's not, you know, they're not looking out into the world. They're chewing on their own perception of the world. It's something that happens. Yeah, it's something that happens when I think you spend too much time isolated. Joyce had the same problem. Ended up later in his work just eating his own brain and not sucking in new experiences.
That's great. I think that's totally it. And it's sort of parts of Ulysses versus, you know, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man or something. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I totally get that, eating his own brain or cranial. It's cranial. I think that's a good way to describe it. Especially the stuff that's contemporary in, you know, contemporary London. But, Midnight's Children is so just exuberant, and it has one of the most amazing scenes of all time.
I've had that on my list and haven't read it yet.
Oh man!
Believe it
or not. Can I tell you? Are you gonna? You would ruin it if I tell you.
No, it won't ruin me at all. Because I enjoy the beauty of the language as much as I do the story. That's my own poetic half. You know, I think that's why I like Ondaatje so much. And
yes, Ondaatje. He's like the perfect example of that.
We'll get it. I'll get into your list, but tell me your midnight story, and then I'll ask you about your guys.
Yeah. Sure. No, the Midnight Children thing, the scene that's just so amazing in it is, so I'll be a little vague so that it won't give anything away, but this one of the characters has shot and killed another character, and has decided he's going to turn himself in. And so he runs, so he just like is in, he's just killed someone, and he's not like a murderer, he's just out of passion. And it was having to do with like his wife, I think, is cheating on him, and like he, like it's her lover, and he shot him.
Right.
He's sitting on the toilet and he shoots him. And and I know. And he like goes out into the street, and he's like blind almost with agony and anguish. And he's like, I have to turn myself in. And so he goes, walks into the street, and it's India, you know, so it's like this deeply, like, crazy chaotic traffic intersection, and there is a policeman standing. There's like these little platforms, on a little concrete like Tesla platform area, like directing traffic with his baton and his white gloves, you know. And so the guy like sees the policeman. He's like, I'm gonna turn myself in, and goes up to the policeman to turn himself in. But he's carrying a gun, you know, he's still carrying the murder weapon, like he's holding it in his hand. So the policeman sees him and like bolts away, like runs away, right? And so then he's like left standing on the like traffic conductor's platform. And so which he does it so perfectly, the way he is, like the sentence is so beautiful. It's like, so then for 15 minutes, he stood there, conducting traffic on the pedestal with a pistol in his hand. So he's using the pistol as a baton to conduct the traffic. And it's just like, and then the cops arrive and take him into custody, you know. But it's just like, it's just an amazing, moment. I just remember, one of my favorite moments in fiction.
Okay, I'm moving that one up the list. I've got... You know me, I used to work at a bookstore, and you know, my ex-girlfriend is the inventory manager there now, and I still just send an email and go, can you order this for me? She goes, yes, it'll be in 3 days, and psh, there it is, and I've got...
Yeah, you know, it's great. It takes, you need some hours, you need a lot of hours, and you need a little bit of you know, some direct light, a good night's sleep the previous night, and you're good.
Yeah, I'm trying to get there. So, okay, who are your guys? You and I kind of bonded, you know, a couple of years ago when Red Weather came out over a mutual love of Ondaatje. So I know that's one of them.
Yeah, he's my. I think he's probably my favorite. I mean, why not one of my favorite? You know, it's not my favorite writer. You know, I told you my story about meeting him. Did I tell you my story about meeting him?
You may have, but I think we were drinking.
I'm sure we were drinking, actually, and I don't doubt it. You know, So what happened is that it was kind of funny. I introduced him as a volunteer. There's this festival called Woodstock in Portland, Oregon, where I live. Mm-hmm. And he came there, and so I volunteered to introduce him. So I introduced him. And then afterwards, my responsibility, sort of, it was a co-responsibility with these two other people who were kind of representatives of the convention center where the conference was being held.
Right.
We had to walk into the area where people were signing his books, where people were waiting for him to sign his books. And he's my literary hero.
Right.
I never met him before, much less like ever walked anywhere with him, with just like another first two people. So like we're walking and like I'm talking to him and I don't know what to say, and it's just really awkward and kind of weird. And so I don't know where we're supposed to go exactly, but I'm told like just follow the two other people, they'll know. So they walk us down like through this convention center, like this little warren, into this room, and like there's a couple authors sitting at the table, but there's no one else in the room, no people to sign the book.
Right.
And so he just sits down at the table. And so we're sitting around waiting, and we're talking. We're still having this kind of awkward conversation, and like, but it's going on and on and on. And it's sort of, it's this weird thing where you're like, you're going to meet the man whose work you just love, and what's going to happen. And but you're going to talk with him for, you know, 25 minutes. And no one wants, and so he's getting kind of depressed. He's like, well, I guess nobody wants me to sign the book. And it's the cat table, right? It's this cat, you know, it's like wildly successful. Anyway, but then all of a sudden someone like rushes in the door and they're like, here he is. And they're like, you walked into the wrong place. Like, and so the other people totally walked into like the children's author's room.
Oh,
and
no.
He was just sitting there, you know, quietly, very unassuming, just sitting there quietly thinking, well, no one wants me to sign the book. And so then they like we all walk him back, and there's a line of 200 people waiting for him to show up, and you know, then I like dropped him off, and it was very funny. I met his daughter-in-law, and so it was this intensely awkward experience because I was also horrified. You know, he was assuming the worst. I was too, I guess.
Right.
And I just, it made me so sad, but I didn't want to admit it. And so it's just very, very, very strange, very strange thing. But anyway, so Ondaatje, In the Skin of a Lion, I really love. Mm-hmm. I love The English Patient, which is a crappy, stupid movie, but a beautiful book, I think. It's one of my favorite books. And I love Running in the Family. Mm-hmm. Coming through Slaughter.
Yeah, I'm rereading Slaughter.
So great. So great. The Nils Ghost is okay. And then the Cat's Table is just awesome.
It's beautiful.
It's just beautiful. It's beautiful. And just going through the Suez Canal, and it's a really gorgeous book. But I think that I really love... I loved... It's funny. It's how much do these works stay with you as you as your brain grows and evolves?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What were you gonna say?
Who else?
Well, I really love a writer, a Uruguayan writer named Eduardo Galeano.
Okay.
He wrote a book called The Book of Embraces that was really important to me. He also wrote Memory of Fire, which is a history of Latin America, and it's his style that I just love more than anything else. He writes in basically a vignette style. He also wrote a book called
soccer in sun and shadow. And those are really just incredible, mm-hmm. incredible books. I love Galliano. I love Virginia Woolf, To the Lighthouse, mm-hmm. Mrs. Dalloway, Jacob's Room, to a lesser extent Orlando, because I think she's just trying to do something different. But when her voice is really there, I think she's just phenomenal. There are individual books that I really loved. Margaret, I love The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's uh-huh. book. You know, I think that's one of my favorite novels. She's an incredible writer. I have poets are very important to me too. W.S. Merwin, the poet, mm-hmm. the contemporary poet, his stuff, especially his stuff from the 60s, is really he has a series of books that were published by Copper Canyon as mm-hmm. The second four books of poems, but that's like The Life and The Carrier of Ladders and a couple other books that are just really amazing. So Merwin, Virginia Woolf, Galliano, The Handmaid's Tale, Michael Ondaatje, Dostoevsky, I love Crime and Punishment. And The Idiot. Actually, the Idiot, I named my character in my first novel, Red Weather, Yuri Mishkin, was named after Prince Mishkin in Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Mm-hmm. So.
I guess I should read The Russian someday.
It's funny. I was talking about this with Peyton, and she's like, "You read such weird stuff," and I'm like, "And when you said that thing earlier in the conversation about transgressiveness, part of it for me was this feeling of discovering something or spending time with someone that you just that is just like just not everybody knows. You know, you're not going to find him or her on a subway somewhere, you know? I don't know. I just, you're not going to see it in the airport kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean...
I don't know why.
Yeah, there's a whole list of writers, you know? It's like, I feel like...
How about you?
Well, my influences? Well, aside from Ondaatje, John Berger...
Ways of Seeing is really interesting.
And his novels. Some of his later novels, like To the Wedding. That one fucking breaks my heart. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
That one's close. That one's close to my heart, To the Wedding. Here Is Where We Meet is one of his more recent ones. He's got this ability to be so... I guess what I want to say is the word that pops in my head right away is naked. There's mm-hmm. There's no irony. There's no mm-hmm. affectation to it. He just, it's incredibly raw and honest and empathetic and there's some rather questionable characters in Here's Where We Meet that on one hand you can think, yeah, that's kind of creepy and disgusting. One of them is a mild pedophile. But this thing is the pedophile's thing is with teenage boys, not with young boys. Right? And he's kind of this really creepy character, at least that's the way I read it the first time, but you kind of had this sense of there's this because the character who's telling the story was the teenage boy that had the relationship with the pedophile, and he's at an older age looking back on this, and he's kind of reached this level of forgiveness and sympathy for the situation, and it's incredibly humane, but it doesn't forgive the character for what he did.
Well, I think that, I mean,
it's astounding.
I think that you said, you know, you said raw, honest, and empathetic. And to mm-hmm. me, that's so important, all those things. You know, I feel like those things are so important for me. Mm-hmm. And I just don't, I mean, and the work that's cranial often doesn't have that. You know, I feel right. like cranial work is kind of the opposite of raw, honest, and empathetic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know.
It's so subjective. Is what the thing is.
It's so subjective.
Yeah. But Lawrence Durrell is another one. The Alexandria Quartet blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. Laird Hunt is a contemporary, sort of. His work astounds me.
Who?
Laird Hunt. His book, Kind One, was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award last year.
Oh, okay. Hold on one second. I'm sorry. Wait, what? Hold on. Wait, what? Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Okay. Sorry. We're
That's right.
Sorry, we're up against bedtime here.
I'll let you go here and
no, but
can you
his work was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner?
Yeah, Kind One was last year.
Oh, I hadn't heard of it. I haven't heard of it, but I don't know anything about the book.
Oh yeah, it's kind of it's very dark. This one, but he's got a new one coming out in September called Never Home, which is about a woman who disguises herself as a man to enlist in the Union Army during the Civil War.
Awesome.
But he's got kind of an Andace like feel to his writing.
How do you spell his last name?
Hunt, Hunt.
Just regular, yeah.
Yep, okay. Laird Hunt. I can send you some details on him.
Send me some links.
But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm trying to discover some new writers, and you know, I hear other contemporary writers, friends that I know who seem to all mention either Virginia Woolf or Eudora Welty, and I feel like I'm missing out on something.
Yeah,
not having
I don't
read them.
Yeah, I don't. Eudora Welty's okay. I mean, I think Eudora Welty's okay. One Writer's Beginnings is a great book. It's like a very short. It's 90 some pages, and it's
right.
very very accessible and fun. And I mean, I don't know. She's. I mean, she's great. She's very talented. It doesn't quite. And the characters are very full and very humane. Mm-hmm. And actually, thinking about. As I'm saying this, like I'm going through a dozen of her stories in my head and a few of her stories in my head and thinking like, oh, I remember that character and that character.
Right.
So it's like, it's very memorable writing, but I don't know. It never sparked me in the same way. Virginia Woolf, I think that Mrs. Dalloway is my favorite just because I think that the portrayal of madness in that book is just so I had never experienced anything that articulated madness in a way
right
that was so clear to me, you know. And then I read the Foucault book about madness, and one of the things that he always says is, you know, madness is a language that I'm paraphrasing and it's crappy, but
it's okay.
Madness is a language that's always on the brink of articulation, but never gets to a full expression of itself.
Right.
And that is very resonant to me as a writer, because I feel like that's what we sort of do as a you know, you're always like on the brink of being able to express this thing that you really want to say, this kind of madness that's inside of you, you know, but you can never quite get there. You can get close, but you never can quite express it. And that's what drives you back to the page time and time and time again.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
But Virginia Woolf in that book with the character of Septimus Smith, who's this shell shock veteran, who has this kind of nebulous, possibly tempestuous, maybe love affair with his commanding officer in the trenches.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's all very buried, but it's there. And you know, he's completely shell shocked, and he's like, the sparrows are singing to him in Greek, and he's and like it's amazing.
Yeah,
incredible character. So yeah.
You know, we'd talked a little bit earlier about discovery as being important to our reading, and you know, I like getting recommendations from friends, especially writers who I admire. You know, so I want to get some Welty read because I'm sure I've read a couple of things here and there, but it never stuck because I was probably forced to read it in high school.
Welty?
You know, yeah. And same thing with Virginia Woolf and you know, bits and pieces from the Russians at various times, you know, kind of forced to read part of it and rebelling against it. And so many people that I know read them and like them and seem to draw something from it. And I feel like I've missed out on that. Of course, I got a late start with being a reader and to begin with, but that's a whole nother story. And then there's also that discovery thing. It's like anything that gets recommended to me, unless I have a specific reason to pull out. Like I'm now trying to get started on Wittgenstein's Mistress.
Oh yeah.
Markson, because I'm playing around with an idea for a really disjointed narrative for a story and wanted some other examples besides, you know, the hybrid stuff of early Ondaatje.
Yeah.
And
I read that. I liked it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, aside of recommendations in that vein, like here, go and read this because it might help you. I always put the recommendations kind of on this, you know, slightly backish burner where it's warm and I'll get to it.
Right, exactly.
But I'm easily distracted by, you know, just stuff I hear about or wander across in the bookstore, and that tends to move up because of that obsession with discovery. Maybe I've found something that no one else has seen yet.
Yes, or yeah, it's not even that no one else has seen yet. It's just that something that will help admit you into that club. You've discovered the thing that is like the passport into like the like territory that, you know, you hold it up at the door and they're like,
right.
Yeah,
it's the hipster quotient of literary discovery.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. Hey, so I'm running up against bedtime here with the kids.
Yep, I figured.
So, yeah.
Do you have time for
one? Yeah, one more question? Sure.
One more question. Okay, I'll try to make this quick because this is the one thing I kind of always ask everybody.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
We always have this – there's always this – seems to be this tension in the literary landscape of you know, literary reading is dying, but, you know, publishing is booming and all this self-publishing stuff. And everybody says that nobody's reading anymore. And it kind of behooves us as writers of a certain type of literature, not genre, not something that's a series, you know, a serial type of thing that can just rope in about, you know, 2,000 readers and make a living at it.
Right.
And it's kind of like my environmentalist question. What do we as writers of a certain type of work need to be doing out in the public to protect our environment and encourage, you know, bravery and reading of more challenging, you know, the stuff that they can't classify as new adult?
Well, I mean, I think that you're doing it right here. I mean, this conversation, this podcast, I mean, what it does for me anyway is this for me reinforces, having a conversation like this reinforces my sense that, you know, literature is something that is valuable and rare and unusual and all those things. So that's something, I mean, this podcast, I think, works to do that for me. I don't know. I think maybe for listeners too, you know, even whoever, and maybe hopefully for you too, you know, I mean, I would imagine doing it, talking with people, you know, that must have it must have an impact on you. I think that, I mean, I think it's a manifold answer, I think. And I think that there's something, I personally feel that books that books belong in paper. Right. And I think that while I, you know, it's hard because I'm traveling. I'm going to Morocco in January for 4 months.
Wow.
And yeah, I'm living, going to be living there. And I'm taking a Kindle with me, which I hate Amazon. I hate Amazon. And I'm going to go to Powell.
Get a Kobo.
Get a Kobo. I'm going to go, yeah, yes. fuck the Kindle. I'm going to go buy a Kobo at Powell. So I'll go buy a Kobo, but I'm going to take it with me. And it's going to be, you know, much easier, I think, than carrying all these books, especially for my kid's book. Maybe just for the kid's book. But I think that books belong in paper, and I think that, you know, reading in paper and you know, trying to have conversations around the things that you read. I mean, I think that is a valuable thing. I mean, even having a conversation face to face with someone is something that's becoming more and more rare. And I know it's rare to begin with in America. You know, it's so easy in America to just drive your car back to your house or take your bus back to your house, you know, or ride your bike back to your house. And then you're in the door and you're in and you're not, and you don't talk to any fucking people ever. So, you know, just having conversations around books, I think, is a really important thing. And then
by
supporting,
making noise, you draw attention, right?
Yes, and then supporting the local independent bookstores, because that is where it lives. That's where it lives. Libraries, yes, libraries too, support libraries, but support the local independent bookstores where somebody, like at Watermark, where somebody, you know, has made it their career to live, to work there, and to live there in a sense, you know. And develops relationships around reading, around ideas, around, you know, around listening and all of these core values that are so important to writers, I think, to many writers. You know, that's been by far the most important thing.
Exactly. That sounds good.
I mean, cool. You know, yeah, I just went and bought. It's funny when you said, I had a stab of guilt when you said series, is because I just went to the local bookstore here in Sun River called Sun River Books. They're really awesome. And I bought Master and Commander. You know, have you read those
No, books? I haven't.
They're like this, it's like this 15 book naval historical fiction swashbuckling.
Oh, I know them. I've shelved them.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You're right. So I got like a little stab, but I bought that. And then I also bought The Black Tulip by Dumas, which is, I'm really excited to read that one too. So, you know, it was really great to go into that store and, you know, it seems to be thriving. So.
All right. Well, you're off to take care of bedtime. Are you working on something new? As always, I assume.
Yes, I'm writing a novel. I don't want to talk too much about it. It's set in the north.
Sweet. And have you placed it yet, or are you just working on it? Okay.
Just working on it. I'm actually just in the. I've been working on doing background stuff, note cards, writing by hand.
Right.
All that stuff.
All right. Well, when it comes out, I'm sure you'll be by Watermark again, and this time we'll go do something, you know, sober and adult.
I know. I still hang out all the time with writers, so, you know, you can't put three writers in a room and they end up at a bar. So I'm fine. I'm fine. I mean, I'm so over it. I'm so comfortable in my sobriety by this point that I just don't. You know, I don't.
How long has it been now?
Okay, so it's July, right?
Yes.
So it's been I guess only a year and 3 months, but still.
No, that's good. That's good. Congratulations,
man. Thank you. Thanks, man. It really does. It does It does embody good.
I bet.
Okay, I'm going to go attend to some shrieking infants or toddlers.
Well, thanks for dropping by. I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, talk to you soon. Hopefully it won't be another 2 years.
Yeah, right.
Okay, all right.
We'll make sure of it. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
All right, that was my conversation with Paul Statunge. I hope you had as much fun with it as Paul's and I did. And, of course, we'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm not sure, again, who is going to be the guest in 2 weeks with the summer vacation and schedules and my schedule and busy times and vacations and whatnot. It's kind of fly by the seat of your pants time. So who knows who will be next? But anyway, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.